As Vicky was talking up here, she turned and said, "But I am resilient." That's been our theme for the month, and a part of that has been this short packet that says, what does it mean to be a people of resilience? Resilience, what does it mean? It means to be able to return to shape, to self, to belonging, to that feeling of right with life. We can think about it to be able to bounce back, but it's really to just return to living and feeling good about being alive. As a part of that, and in this packet, there are short readings, and we've been picking different short readings that speak to us at different times. The one we did last week was from the Hopi elders, which said, "We must let go of the shore, push off into the middle of the river, and keep our heads above water. And I say, see who is there with you. The time of the lone wolf is over." It went on and then concluded that we are the ones we've been waiting for. That was the point of reading that is the one we noticed, or I noticed, and then our group Spirituality on Tap noticed at the time. But there are others in this packet. How many of you have actually looked at this packet online or visited it? See, there are just a handful of folks here who are doing it. But I commend it to you. And you say, I don't have time to do that. That's right. I can't find the time. That is not a resilient response. That's a reactive response. That's a response that is being controlled by the lack of time. If we don't have time, we don't have life. We don't have us. If we don't have the moment, where are we? They're short readings. And I was going through them again, and one that caught my notice this time was very different. It's one I skimmed over and said, that doesn't speak to me. I'm not going back to that. But it's one by Mark Nepo. "We all have these moments when the rose loses its color for some reason, or the music no longer stirs us, or the sweet, gentle soul across from us no longer seems to soften our heart. To move in and out of meaning is as natural as moving in and out of light, because clouds form and dissipate. It reminds me of a man who built a home on a cliff by sea, only to have a month-long fog roll in. He cursed the place and moved away. But a week after he'd gone, the fog cleared. Being human, we all have fogs roll in around our heart, and often our lives depend on the quiet courage to wait for them to clear. I don't have enough time, but do I have the quiet courage to wait for it to clear?" I think about, well, the other thing we did was we've talked about faith as meaning, and he says, to move in and out of meaning is as natural as moving in and out of light, because clouds form and dissipate. For the last 2 years, I've been talking about faith not as a box set of beliefs, but as meaning making, as that larger sense of meaning that gives us the feeling of belonging. Or as Neil used the word home, of being at home in the universe. Sharon Parks, whom I read and reference fairly often, and we talked about last week, says when she talks about faith as a primal force of promise, she says, "In the ups and downs of daily life, human beings experience an ongoing dialogue between fear and trust, hope and hopelessness, power and powerlessness, alienation and belonging. The fog rolls in." Yet mature faith has learned that though the forms of faith are finite, the promise is kept. The promise of a rudimentary sense of trustworthy pattern, wholeness, and relation, a sense of an ultimate environment that intends our good. The other thing I've been thinking about is resilience, is being bent and then being able to return to shape. We think about it in relation to plants. A resilient plant can be bent and returned to shape. How many of you feel the weight of the world on you? Exactly. How many of you feel the weight of the world? How many of you come to me and say, I just read this, or I just heard this, or there's this going on or that going on? The weight of the world. Well, what is it that gives you the resilience to go, I'm here again. The weight of the world is not on my back. Resilience. It's not about control. Preparation and practice are keys to being resilient. Skills and tools are keys to being resilient. But it's really about how do we respond to what life brings us, what comes at us, both outside and inside, the world and our feelings. A resilient faith is one that gives you a structure of meaning from which you can respond. When I wrote this service up originally, I asked people in the blurb, I had the idea is that we'd share our failures. We shared those moments where we'd been so down that we couldn't see up and talk about what brought us back. We'd kind of remember that. And I asked for people to respond to that. Well, nobody did. But I know the stories in here, in this room. I know there's stories in every seat. All of you who are worried about being perfect, in every seat there is a story of being so down you couldn't see up. There is a story of trying something and it failed, but you tried it and somehow you came back from that sense. There is a story of crushing loss. There's a story of illness that just disrupts everything you understand. There's a story of ending, but then coming back. And I thought, all right, let's change this. If I'm talking about a resilient faith, you have to be able to respond to what life brings. Nobody shared a story, so I said, I'll stand up here and ask you for your questions that are on your heart and on your mind. This isn't stump the minister time. This is that sense of why you came this morning. What is the yearning that brings you out in this day? And if it forms a question or concern. So let's take a Quaker moment and sit in a little bit of silence and see if one of those questions or concerns comes to mind. There's a piece of paper in your order of service. If you feel better writing it down, you can hand it in. If you'd like to raise your hand and share it, that would be great too. So, do we want to have complete silence, or would you like to have something playing while you... What's the vote? I'd like some music. I heard, can you... Give us a little Quaker meditation music here, Kevin. Thank you. Okay. Did anybody write anything down?
Yes.
Want to just raise your hand and we'll come. Okay. This one. Anybody? Would anybody like to, didn't write something down, but would like to ask it? Anybody else? Bill? Oh, you didn't write something down? Okay.
Thank you. I'm Bill Elder. Among the many reasons that I'm here at UUFH is a belief in the loving nature of the universe, and that the universe, the arc is long but bends toward justice, and those are things that I believe or try and believe every day. And then I read a newspaper or I see an evening newscast, and suddenly that sense of resilience is overwhelmed by the things that I see going on. And I guess most times I sort of shield myself from the pain of the world in order not to have my resilience really crushed. And so I struggle with the dichotomy of that and how to live and be in the space that I want to be in given those contrary factors. So the question is, how do you do that?
Okay. I tried this once before. And I went to the ministers' meeting at the mountain, and I did worship, and it was in November, and it was on extemporaneous preaching. So you're supposed to get up there without notes and give a sermon. And so they changed the schedule on me and when I was supposed to present and how it all fit, so what I prepared didn't fit. And when I got there, I said, okay, I'm just going to ask ministers, what is the sermon that's on their heart or their mind they'd like to come? And you say, well, that's a dumb thing to do. But I did two things in order to do that. I took the chalice with me because it's my compass. When I talk to you about faith, that's that organizing structure of the way the universe works, the way we find hope, and the way we live our lives in the face of all the things that say otherwise. And in living out in this congregation, in this profession, in this job, I've had to come to an understanding of what is the practice that allows me to do that. And I use this, and I've talked about it several times, and we get it. We hear things at different levels in different moments, but as my compass. The reason I say that is it just reminds me. Two circles, you hear me say, our universalist heritage talks about a loving God. There's a question about that in here. There's a question about an inclusive universe. Supportive universe. It says that we live in an inclusive universe where one, the sun shines on everybody, we're one human family, one nature, one origin, one destiny. And so let's just hold that. And then the Unitarian part is an exalted view of human possibility with religious exemplars, originally Jesus as an exemplar. So you can look to those teachings about how to live your life. And what do they say? What do they keep coming back? The Buddhist sayings say, be present in the moment. Don't be sucked away to the despair of the future. How do you be present in the moment? What do you need to do? You need to live in the instructions, in the guidance of what is loving and compassionate and connecting. Pretty much, you know? Get into the details of it, you know? What do they say? Love your neighbor as yourself, you know? And what did the rabbi say? The rest of the Torah is just details. Okay? And then the third piece is the flame. It's kind of what do we do? The flame of our actions, our activities, our spirit. What do we do? Well, it's about practice. That we keep making the inclusive vision of the universe real in our culture and in our society, and the teachings real in our lives. The fourth thing is the space inside the circle. It's both the nature of the universe coming through, but it's also the understanding of beloved community. By actually coming together here, we create the space that we hope allows us to be our better selves, that makes that inclusive nature real, that calls us out to being present and not just reactive with each other, and allows us to do good things in the world. Beloved community, that's what we're trying to do. So you say, well, beloved community isn't changing the world. It isn't making a difference. There are two questions here that address that. I'll try to get to one. I'll have to ask for explanation on it. How do we maintain active hope in the face of climate change? When beloved community seems to move away, what can we do to keep those doors open? All right, so we keep coming. And then there's what Bill was saying that all fit into this. Strength and courage to build a balance between fulfilling the needs of others and myself. Oh, let's put that one away for a while. Okay. How do you maintain active hope in the face of climate change? That's the very question that I asked when I went to divinity school. It's a question that sent me to quit my job in the Nature Conservancy as a director of stewardship and conservation biology and go off and examine it from a different angle, sort of. My thesis was on hope. You've heard me talk about that before, but it was called Helplessly Hoping, an exploration of fundamental hope, and I ask, what meaning can the word hope have when the future seems impossibly bleak and you don't believe in an intervening or a managing God? You can tell by how fast I said that I actually wrote that. There are two kinds of hope. One is the hope that we hear about. It's a hope that. It's a hope in the future, a hope that the future will be different and that we can change it. It's also a hope, and I'm not saying these in opposition, it's a hope that's tinged by fear. It is that we're afraid that the dire possibilities, let's use climate change as an example. It also, at my time, it applied to the diagnosis of AIDS at that point, or it applies to cancer diagnoses. You can apply this in many different ways, okay? That's the hope that. I do everything I can. That's not true. I do a lot to try to reduce my carbon footprint. But you still see me driving a vehicle that allows me to carry a paddleboard so I can go to the lake and have fun. It uses more gas. All right? And every time somebody moves a yacht in a yacht basin, they use up everything I've put together and saved for years in a few minutes. So, and we're now at 6 billion people when we were at 3 billion when I was 6 years old, and we're headed to 7, 8, okay? There's another hope that is a fundamental hope. It resides within the hope that. And it's the hope that joy can be experienced no matter the future. In a medical model, there's healing to be found even when there is no cure. In the present, it's the moment of saying, please notice the sunrise, or what we talked about springtime. And there are people sitting in here today, and I do it the same way, who discount that by what it's not doing to change climate change. And so you discount those moments of joy, of love, of presence, because they're not changing the future in your mind. And so we don't even get to experience them. That's a hope in, that there's joy to be found even in the present, even if the future seems impossibly bleak. The image of that is of one green shoot in the whole landscape of a blown-out Mount St. Helens volcanic eruption with nothing alive but this one green shoot. Nothing. And you go, ah, that's one green shoot. That's a whole forest out there, you know. It's blown off a mountainside. But there it is. And that's my picture of joy, of life force, of creation, always trying to break through into our awareness, resilience, given half a chance. We can easily discount it. We can put our foot on that green shoot because it doesn't fit. You know, that has nothing to do with climate change. I don't have much hope that we're going to turn climate change around in the hope that. I don't have much hope. But in order to keep working for that change, I have to live very presently to do my piece so I don't burn out. I can't put all my hope out there. It creates all this emptiness in here because I'm working desperately, desperately, despair to change the future. I'm scared. So, and I am. I'm not saying not. But I'm going to live fully right here. I'm going to live in loving, connected, small ways which are at the scale of my competence and my life. So that's how I maintain active hope. I would not bring a child into the world before I understood that form of hope. That's how powerful it is to me. I said, I can have a child now because I know that she can live with hope, even though she's living later than I am. So, an inclusive universe, a beloved community, we participate in that while we're trying to change what we're doing in our own greed and focus on things that don't work. When beloved community seems to move away, what can we do to keep those doors open? I just said it in terms of fundamental hope in our behavior. There's nothing that destroys beloved community quicker than for the individuals in us, of us, to get so task-focused that we say our actions are, we're justified in behaving badly because the cause we're trying to achieve is good. We have to keep coming back to this notion of, okay, we've created oppositional moments now. How do we create the space? Look around you in the sanctuary. It's curved because this is an embrace, the beloved community. How do you create the space? When you see beloved community collapse, disappear, start thinking about, okay, and I've done it. I mean, I've done my actions in the last month where I've gotten task-focused and the person I was with just all of a sudden, and they're still mad at me, okay? But then you start asking the question, and I was doing my job, you know, but I did it with the task again, but then you start asking, okay, I understand this now. How do I make the space for love, for beloved community and connection to come back in? And that's why the third piece of this understanding is so key. Practice over and over and over again. Resilience is the key. Keep coming back. Because you have all kinds of reasons to say everything I've just said is not important enough, is not weighty enough, is not intellectual enough, is not socially active enough. And in all of those, you're discounting the very love and belonging that brought you into the world and that brings you up in the world and that you want to see lived out in the world. And it's the reason that you're concerned about these factors in the world. So we have to behave in the way we want to see the world to be from the get-go. Does that change how you feel and how mad you get and how frustrated? Or absolutely not. I can't do anything about that. That's also why I'm not standing up here as a savior. That's also why we don't look at Jesus as your personal savior in relation to saving you from all of that. Now, you could look at it as a personal savior from the sense of save you into right relationship with life by how you behave and live and do and be. So how do we maintain beloved community? All right. Always saddened to hear of kids with tough home life, but relieved that there are places like Boys and Girls Club. Absolutely. There are kids who are homeless. What did we say in the This I Believe? One of the things I wrote is that I believe that weighing my actions by what does this mean for children is a good guiding statement. So I try to think when I'm doing things, what does this mean for children, for our children? That's how the Dream Scholarship idea was born. I said, okay, I can't change immigration laws. I can't make them change. But oh, this is exactly what we're talking about. I can't make the immigration laws change. I can keep working for that, but I don't have to wait for them to change to ask the question, how do I make Hendersonville be a more caring, loving community and take care of its own children within the scale of my competence of what I can do? So you just keep working with it and being moved and saddened and not being hardened and feeling helpless in relation to it. And that's, again, the beloved community's role, is to support you in those little efforts and acknowledging and noticing them. Strength and courage to build a balance between fulfilling the needs of others and myself. We've been talking about the notion of a hidden wholeness, Parker Palmer's notion of leading an undivided life, and it has to do with what Thomas Merton says, that hidden wholeness is the integrity that resides within us. And that's that integrity of being who I am and who I'm meant to be in the world, not living out the shoulds and oughts and expectations that are outside us all the time. What was that line I read about fears and failures, hope and hopelessness that goes on every day? I struggle with this all the time. I'm a codependent human being. I just am. I start thinking about it. It hurts me when people are upset with me. I try to figure out how to get right with them. I think about things. How do I do it right? Well, when I'm doing that, I'm living their drama with my life rather than living my life as a compassionate human being connecting with others. So it's keeping coming back into, we talked about like my gymness, you know, who I am in the world. I'm in a position where you may not like that and you may let me know that. And I struggle with then your issues and what's going on with you and how to connect it with me in that space all the time. And that's what you're talking about. Sort of how do I settle into who I am in the world? And if you look around this room, when we go back to faith, meaning making on a personal level, I trust every one of you to be faithful human beings, living lives of meaning in relation to what we're talking about trying to create that inclusive nature in our own society, all right? Trying to live out lives of integrity, trying to put good practice into the world. But one of the key things is you have to believe it yourself, that each one of you has been born to be you, not to be all these oughts and expectations, that and to be people pleasers necessarily, but that's really hard to do. And that's the religious space, is not to be reactive to all the drama that's in the people around you, on the screen around you, in the news around you, but to come back into that wholeness and believe that it's good. Believe that you're good in that space. How can a person believe in one unified God and still believe that reality is quantized? Does whoever wrote that kind of help me out here real briefly? I'm not sure I believe in one unified God in terms of comparing it to what reality is. If you take a step back from the question of that, we live in something that there's a wholeness to that's way beyond my understanding. But go ahead. Not with a... Just what do you mean?
Well, this has been something I've been struggling with for several years. You may know I have been a physicist, and I was a physicist with him, and we've read a lot of physics, and the physicists are just totally convinced that reality is breaking up in little pieces, and they keep asking what's the smallest piece of reality you can have, and da da da. But how can you believe that reality needs to be broken up into little pieces without believing that God needs to be broken up into little pieces?
Okay, I can handle that. I don't. It comes back to how I started talking, in that if we stick in the question of God or not God, or if a physicist, and I've done physics myself, but if a physicist tells you they can know everything, then I move into the sense of, I have a sense of something more. That was my religious move, is that there was a certain humility, a humbling. I was an evolutionary biologist, which takes off from physics and the Big Bang and goes all the way through genetic stuff and into human behavior and being able to explain it all, yada, yada, yada. So this isn't going to help you, but if you take the question God or not God, all right, and you just move that much, all of a sudden, you say, well, one person's either an agnostic or an atheist and the other's a believer, God or not God. But let's say in the God or not God question, but there's all of this around us that's not about that question at all. And there are people in this room who believe in God. There are people in this room who don't believe in God. There are people in this room who believe in many gods. There are people in this room who are... don't really care about God, and people who care very deeply about God and have personal relationships. But one thing we share is a certain orientation where this compass can guide us in the world. We share the orientation of, if it is God, it's a loving God. There is no hell. An orientation of an inclusive universe in the nature of how we live. What I read about a fundamental promise, whether you believe in a promise giver or not. That's what you're living in. So how do you live fully into that space? I will not argue with physicists about... I think quantum physics is extremely interesting and gives us an awful lot of tools and an awful lot of insights. But then I step back into my religious sense of something more, which includes that too. I'm not, even when Stephen Hawking says, we will know the mind of God. Okay, you know. But I can move into that argument, but there's no need to for me. So I'm not discounting the question. I'm just saying I don't live it anymore like that because it doesn't do anything of value for me once I just move a little bit into the experience of how I'm trying to be in the world and how I practice. I find that practicing and spending a lot of time on the question of God or not God, tell me how it applies to your life. I mean, seriously, tell me that that's not just one of those, almost similar to one of the political issues that keep us away from the important things. So, I think I need to wrap it up with my answers here. Anybody else? I did have a little note here. If you turn to Mary Oliver's poem, 536, it's a morning poem. And if you had our reading, we talk about being resilient as not being individuals and being able to look around us into the community or even awake in the morning of a difficult day and reach out to a sense of something more. And if we talk too about Buddhist monk Thich Nhat Hanh's gatha, which says, I awake in the morning, I give thanks for 24 brand new hours. The sun is rising on the forest and also on my awareness. If you settle into that moment, you don't go, I give thanks for 24 brand new hours. But damn, a lot of people are driving their cars and getting new refrigerators and contributing to the carbon layer. More people are being born. You know, you can't go on like that. I give thanks for 24 brand new hours. The sun is rising on the forest and also my awareness. So I can participate in making that future different. If you read Mary Oliver's poem, and you can always turn to it, it says, every morning the world is created. And then she goes on, says, if it is your nature to be happy, you will swim away along the soft trails for hours, your imagination alighting everywhere. And if your spirit carries within it the thorn that is heavier than lead, if it's all you can do to keep on trudging, there is still somewhere deep within you a beast shouting that the earth is exactly what it wanted. That isn't saying society is exactly what it should be. The earth is exactly what it wanted. Each pond with its blazing lilies is a prayer heard and answered lavishly every morning. Whether or not you have ever dared to be happy, whether or not you have ever dared to pray. First line, every morning the world is created. Last lines, whether or not you have ever dared to be happy, whether or not you have ever dared to pray, to reach out beyond you. There is hope. There is this community which keeps bringing hope back and turning it into actions that make a difference in the world. Whatever the future turns out to be, we keep trying, we keep doing, and we keep living out of this sense that joy and happiness, I would say joy, because joy is that deeper sense of happiness connected to real life and love, are possible given half a chance. And it's our job to keep that alive and be that half a chance. We are a people of resilience. We just have to keep doing it over and over and over and over again.